Hey, y'all, how's it going?
Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Gotta click some things here, man. Click, click. All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Writing up a blog entry here for the Stress Blog. Today's show, me yelling at you for 2 hours. Noon to 2 Eastern. No guests today, just me complaining. At first I thought, man, I want to get all these guests on the show to talk to them about the things that they wrote, but then I thought, no, you know, actually, I just want to yell and complain myself for 2 hours. I have so much news to cover here. I keep thinking, who should I interview about this? Who should I interview about that? I'm going to interview myself. You don't have to listen if you don't want. ScottHorton.org. That's where I keep all the archives, the whole show archives, and the interview archives as well. Sign up for the podcast feed. Leave a nice note about how much you like the show on iTunes. Got a few nice reviews there. Thanks very much to the people who have put some there. That helps with the rankings and things and expose more people to the show, I guess. So that's a thing. Sign up for the podcast feed. Check out the whole show archives or the interview archives. I got 3,500 plus interviews going back to 2003. If you want to learn everything about everything, just spend the next couple of years catching up, I guess. I don't know. ScottHorton.org/interviews. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Although a lot of people seem to think that they don't like me when they read my tweets. I guess I'm not always as classy as I am here live on the radio show. Sometimes I recommend that people kill themselves and other stuff like that on Twitter just because I have a lot of hate. A lot of hate. But anyway, if you're sure you want to, you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. And, so when I'm not on the air, that's where I do my complaining mostly. I up and quit Facebook, man, a year ago. I'm over it. Over Facebook. I'm so glad I'm not on Facebook anymore. I miss my Facebook people. There were Facebook people that was how I communicated with them, and those days are over now, and that is kind of a shame. But I don't miss Facebook itself. Got tired of that thing. And especially the way they throttle down everybody's views. You don't get to see what you sign up to see, what you click, like, and follow on, or who you friend. They choose for you to such an insane degree. Yeah, it ain't worth the time. All right, anyway. I quit that damn Facebook like cigarettes. And feel great. Less cancer, hopefully. All right. So, news. I got Israeli news, Israel-Iran stuff. I got Iraq war and Syria. I got Yemen, Ukraine, torture, the cops. I believe those are my subject matters today. Lots and lots of subject matters. yeah, man. I have trouble deciding where to start some days. I guess the most important thing is going to be the war, our war, the big war. House Democrat introduces ISIS war authorization bill. Eat your heart out, Rand Paul. Democrat Adam Schiff from California introduced legislation Wednesday to authorize, that's this morning, I guess, to authorize military force against Islamic State militants, a step aimed at forcing Congress to take responsibility for a war it's been funding for nearly 6 months with almost no debate on its duration, costs, or potential toll. Lawmakers have put no parameters on the U.S. military campaign against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, since it began in August. Since then, the U.S. has spent more than $1 billion, participated in more than 1,700 airstrikes, and authorized, that's bombing raids, and authorized sending roughly 3,000 U.S. troops to Iraq, All of this has happened without a new war authorization. Schiff's proposed authorization for the use of military force would do three things. Limit military action against ISIS to 3 years, which he copied that from Rand Paul. And I don't even see how they think that's going to fly. Maybe that's just to make it a little bit more politically palatable. But, well, whatever. They don't have to pass an authorization in the first place. Obama can wage the war without them in the first place. He can certainly keep waging it after the sun set on whatever law they decide to pass meaninglessly after the fact anyway, right? It would prohibit the use of U.S. ground troops. Well, this really is a copy of what Rand Paul tried to do. Again, this makes no sense. To authorize military force, but only air power and proxies and spies and special forces and mercenaries. But no troops, no Marines, no infantry. Really? Well, what if the commander-in-chief says he needs that? Then all of a sudden, you don't just have Lyndon Johnson picking targets in the White House. You have Congress deciding how to move the troops in the battlefield in a war they've declared. Yeah, right. So point two scored just as untenable as the time limit, just like Rand Paul's Senate bill from December. And the third thing it would do would be to end the last authorization to use military force. And I'm not sure whether in Iraq, I'm not sure whether Rand's bill did that or not, but it's sort of beside the point. That's just a technical matter because Saddam Hussein's regime is gone. They want to declare war against Iraq again. They need a new one. But, nope, so there you go. And as this article, which I'm reading from Huffington Post, Jennifer Bendery at the Huffington Post's article, of course, she's exactly right. The president's been waging this war without authorization since August. And so this is barely even symbolic, really. And you see how desensitized we get, man, you know? It was a big deal back when George H.W. Bush, only kind of at the last minute, after he was certain he had the votes, did he even decide to go to Congress. But his administration said he didn't really need Congress, but they blinked, basically. They had claimed a UN authorization, Security Council authorization, was good enough. And then at the last minute, they blinked and they went to Congress and they got their authorization for the first Gulf War. George W. Bush, even though he was pretending that Saddam was friends with Osama, he didn't pretend that the post-September 11th authorization to use military force against al-Qaeda or those who helped with the 9/11 attacks in any way applied to Iraq. He went and got a brand new authorization based on lies in October of 2002 and then applied that and started the war in March of 2003. And, of course, Bush waged some covert wars here and there. But Obama has really, set the precedent in a way that Dick Cheney must really admire with the war in Libya, where he said basically he just lawyered his way out of it. He just Clintoned his way out of it. Oh, see this? It isn't really a war because we're just supplying all the money and all the bombs for the French to do it and giving them the intelligence and picking all their targets for them and sending our spies and special forces and mercenaries to do it. And so it doesn't count as a war. It's just a kinetic action. Kinetic. See, it's just a, see, what we did was we made up a new word, and then that means that no old law applies to our activities. You like that? Okay, good. In Congress, the Republicans in Congress, in the House of Representatives, they tried to pass an authorization. It failed. They tried to pass a deauthorization. It failed too. And so they just left the Libya war unauthorized, undeclared. And Obama fought it. The Syria thing is more of a so-called covert op. Didn't really need Congress as far as that goes. But for the war against the Islamic State, maybe get around, I guess, authorization more than half a year later after the war started. I will make it legal. Hey, Al Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So Israel, Iran, and politics and all that stuff coming up here in a little while, but I want to tell you a little bit more about the Iraq War. Talked with Prothero on the show yesterday, and I was hoping for some good news. It is my position that the Islamic State guys are about the scum of the earth, lower even possibly than the Democrats or the Republicans, and that they don't have much of a natural constituency. The tribal chiefs would rather be tribal chiefs than subordinates of a self-proclaimed caliph over there. And as I've been trying to make the case since before the fall of Mosul and the declaration of the caliphate, the best way to defeat the Islamic State is to stop fighting them, because America's just making matters worse. The best hope for their destruction isn't even any of their surrounding enemies, and they're surrounded by enemies, landlocked and surrounded by enemies. But it's the local Sunni tribes who, back in 2006 and 7, decided, we don't really like taking orders from you Al-Qaeda in Iraq, guys, and now we're going to kill you, and did so. They had a lot of help from the Americans at the time. It was their choice to do it. Everybody gives Petraeus the credit, but it was a lot easier for them to do it with, you know, Petraeus as the arrow in their quiver there. They used the, we're talking about basically after the Sunnis lost the civil war for Baghdad, they then made a compromise with the Americans to turn on the Al-Qaeda guys and marginalize them, the so-called awakening movement. And that's our best hope for what could happen there now in a way that would end the Islamic State. I don't believe would put Iraq back together again. I think Sunnistan will be independent from now on, rather than under any kind of rule of Baghdad. However, that doesn't mean it has to be the Islamic State that rules from Raqqa to Mosul down through Tikrit and Fallujah, etc. And I think that really, if everybody would just stop, the thing will work itself out. Because these Islamic State guys, they're bastards. Everywhere they take over, they don't inspire loyalty, only fear. And they're scum. And they wore out their welcome very quickly back a few years ago. And now it's true that the group seems to be much more dominated by actual Iraqis than it was back then. That was part of their problem, as so many of them were foreigners. But then again, they're bringing in foreigners from all over the place. And Baghdadi is saying that... yeah, no, there's no such thing as Iraq. There's no such thing as Syria. There's no such thing as any of these states. All loyal Muslims in the world, come here and let's all create an Islamic State together. And they're very progressive that way. But the problem with that is, of course, is that means that all the local Iraqis who are from there, they don't care maybe whether you call it Iraq or not, but they certainly don't want to be bossed around by a bunch of Saudis and Egyptians and people who clearly are not from there. And so, you know, especially the Europeans who come, although they get used up in suicide bombings pretty quick, I guess. But anyway, the point is that the Iraqi Sunnis have plenty of reason to get rid of the people who have foisted themselves on them, the Islamic State. And so I'm not advocating leave it to the Iranians or to the Jordanians or to Assad or the Turks or anyone else. I'm saying leave it to the Sunnis of, you know, Iraqi Sunnistan and of eastern Syria there, and let them work out their own damn problems. It really is the best way to handle it. And just like I told you all along, they're in such a weak position. They're completely landlocked. They're completely surrounded by enemies. Go around the list counterclockwise with me, right? In the southeast, from Baghdad to Kuwait is Shiistan. They're avowed enemies forever and ever and ever and ever. To the east of there is those guys' friends, the Iranians, who have their back no matter what. Then going north, you have the Kurds. Then going around, you had the Turks who've been nice with ISIS, but certainly don't mean to, you know, join them or be ruled by them. So their border is certainly secure. It's a semi-permeable membrane there. Jihadis can go from Turkey into Iraq and Syria, but they have the ability to keep that border tight to keep them out if they want them out. Assad has stood his ground against them in at least the rump of the third of Syria that he's got left, which is actually all the major cities. And then you have the Jordanians who are armed and trained and financed by the Americans and the Israelis, and they probably could not invade Iraq and do anything about the Islamic State, but they can certainly hold their own border, according to Eric Margolies, no problem. They can keep them out. And then there's the Saudis, who reportedly have had a little bit of trouble on the border, but that's a big border, and that's a lot of desert sand, and should not be too difficult for the Saudis to keep the Islamic State out. Now, are they liable? Are they, you know, possibly subject to an Islamist revolution there in sympathy and in league with the Islamic State at some point? I don't know, maybe. But as far as the Islamic State invading from Iraq down into the Arabian Peninsula, yeah, right. Never even mind that they have the Americans to help them. Never even mind that. So the Islamic State is completely landlocked. And where the Taliban in Afghanistan back in the 1990s and early 2000s were at least recognized by Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, the Islamic State is recognized by no other state, nor will it ever be recognized by any other state. They have trade relations with no other state. The only trade that they can engage in is on the black market. And then, you know, black market oil, you have to sell it not artificially high prices, but artificially low ones, because there's an open market in oil. If you want to undercut the open market and people are going to, you know, take a risk of getting in trouble for dealing with you, you got to give them a discount. So their oil revenue is very low, and really the vast majority of Iraq's oil resources are in Kurdistan and in the far south, where the Islamic State can't get their hands on them. And so they're complete jerks. They're completely isolated physically and diplomatically and capitalistically. And so the Islamic State is an equation for its own doom. They will do themselves in. They are doing themselves in. Look at how much of their wad they blew trying to take Kobani and then lost it anyway. Huge public relations disaster, but also a real disaster in terms of the guys that they lost. I don't know, maybe it was propaganda, but I remember reading one story out of Raqqa where all the Islamic State fighters in Raqqa are gone. They all went off to Kobani to fight, and now the newly recruited policemen are complaining to the reporter that, man, we just got word that we have to go to Kobani to get killed. That sucks. We only just signed up, and we wanted to be local cops, but we're the reserves, so off we go. Wish us luck. Well, I don't know. On the other hand, they do seem to have floods of foreign fighters coming in ever since the Americans started bombing them back in August. So it's a balance there. And of course, you know, the Americans are killing them from the air. They're getting killed while they're also being replenished. So who knows exactly how that'll balance. But Prothero was saying they're much more powerful, and Coburn says the same thing, much more powerful than AQI was back when. So I'm afraid this is going to be a long war and that American intervention is only going to escalate. Next, why it's all America's fault in the first place.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I saw a little thing this morning. It was going around on Twitter. Oh, I know, it was Mar Arar tweeted it out. It was a little documentary put together by Vice News, and it's Mark Danner, the journalist Mark Danner, who is one of America's greatest experts on the torture regime. And It begins with him quoting from an essay he wrote at the very beginning of the war in 2003, predicting the rise of the Islamic State, sort of, kind of, as a consequence of the war and the occupation. And then there he is explaining, basically, the interviewer is all cut out, and it's just Danner's answers, basically explaining why ISIS is all America's fault. With one glaring omission, which I guess I'll get to that in a second. Syria. But anyway, he's right that, and I'll urge you again to go read the interview with Osama bin Laden's son in Rolling Stone in 2010, where he talks about how basically George W. Bush came to office with Mark written on his forehead. This idiot, this pretend tough guy, is going to be so easy to manipulate. Watch. And that was, bin Laden really explains it well in his 2004 speech about how it's all about getting you to overreact. Giving your political leaders, Americans, an excuse to take advantage in order to enrich their corrupt cronies and run the empire into the ground. That was what he's doing. America is the big dumb bull. Osama the matador. Simple. That's what terrorism is always about. Provoking an overreaction. Simple. And what they were trying to do was get America to invade Afghanistan, so they could replicate the war against the Soviets in the 1980s, which they believe bled the Soviet Union to bankruptcy and destruction. Osama bin Laden's mentor, Abdul Azzam, told Eric Margolies back in 1988, "We're coming for you next, Yankee imperialist." And that was their plan. And the jihadi war started long before September 11th. It waged all through the 1990s. And this following advice goes for Ron Paul and for any other libertarian or, well, for that matter, honest left-winger, liberal, or progressive, too, but especially for libertarians and right-wingers. If you're having trouble, I notice Ron Paul never uses this turn of phrase. It would work so much better. I saw him being interviewed by Newsmax TV, and he's trying to explain America's intervention provoked the September 11th attack. Wouldn't it be so much easier to get the point across to Newsmax TV if you would say Bill Clinton provoked the attack? Bill and Hillary, with their mass murders, with their blockade, and their bombing of Iraq for 8 years straight from bases in Saudi Arabia. Get it right, right-wingers. It's all Bill Clinton's fault. Remember him? The Barack Obama of the 1990s? Yeah, he's the reason America was attacked on September 11th. Because of the evil, vile, criminal sins he committed, provoked blowback against our wonderful country. Get it? There. That way, your wonderful military and your police and all the bureaucrats that you worship so much, they don't have to be made responsible. It's not America's fault. It's Bill Clinton's fault. Bill Clinton kept giving American tax money to the Israeli government to use to murder people's babies with. And guess what? It pissed them off. And so America was attacked. Because they were trying to replicate the Soviet blunder in Afghanistan. Now, Margolies doesn't believe it. Margolies says that this is Brzezinski just patting himself on the back, giving himself extra credit. But Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, the Democrat Party Kissinger, basically, Rockefeller's man, he's the guy who says that he deliberately supported the Mujahideen in their war against the Soviet commie sock puppet in Kabul in the late 1970s in order to trick the Soviets into invading and occupying Afghanistan. The way he says it now is that he sent a memo to Jimmy Carter saying, "Now we will give them their own Vietnam." Vietnam being shorthand for suicide, murder, suicide. When a world empire bogs itself down in an absolutely cannot win trap, bankrupts itself, divides the society back home, and loses in disgrace and humiliation. That's what Vietnam means. And now we will give them their own Vietnam, said the genius Brzezinski, who did it to him on purpose, back when I was two, he claims. And yet somehow it would be brilliant for us to give ourselves our own Vietnam again, huh? Yeah, let's do that. Let's do what we ha-ha deliberately did to the Soviets to ourselves. And they at first resisted a little bit. They actually kind of outsourced the war and all that. As Mark Danner says, oh man, they did way better for bin Laden than invading and occupying Afghanistan. They invaded and occupied Iraq, 1,500 miles west of there. Entirely on the other side of Shiite Iran from there. Within a stone's throw of the Levant. And they overthrew a fascist, secular, beret-wearing, olive-green-wearing, atheist dictatorship. And then they fought a war for the Sunnis' worst enemies, not just the Shia, but the Ba'ath Brigade power drill torturers. Read about it on antiwar.com/blog right now. America fought the war for the Ayatollah Khomeini's worst butchers. And fought a war to give them Baghdad and to drive the Sunnis completely out of power. And as I was saying on the show earlier, they don't really have much oil. There's some oil in Sunnistan, but it's not well developed. And it's nothing like what's available near Kirkuk and down near Basra, out of their hands. When they control the central government, they control that oil wealth. When they don't, screwed. And I warned you for years about this too, because Bob Dreyfus explained about it for years what was going on. The Iranian parties, those are the Ba'ath Brigade and the Dawa Party, or the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party. Those are the guys that Bush chose to back. The ones who were most backed by Iran, and the ones whose obvious motive, declared motive all along, was to take Baghdad and run off with it, to create what they call strong federalism, meaning they're too smart to want to try to rule Fallujah and the Anbar province, to want to try to rule Tikrit and Bakuba and Mosul. Let the Sunnis rot in the sun. Who cares what happens to them? We got southern Shiistan. That was the Iranian policy all along. You were warned all along. And the government did that anyway, succeeded in fighting that pro-Iran war in Iraq anyway, and then were promptly kicked the hell out by the people that we helped win. Thanks, we don't need you anymore. You can get lost. They would have needed us if they wanted to dominate Sunnistan forever, but they didn't. They just wanted to sit back and watch the Sunnis starve and laugh. So they didn't need America anymore. As Mitchell Prothero, who's reporting from Irbil, keeps telling you, the Shia, they don't want to go fight and die for Fallujah. You can't find a Shia in Basra who wants to go die to try to occupy Fallujah, which is basically a foreign country from there. Those days are over. Iraqi nationalism is over. But anyway, so what George Bush did is he turned all those Sunnis desperate enough to ally with Zarqawi and the group that became Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that eventually, you know, transformed itself into the Islamic State that we're fighting today. And it's a great little interview of Mark Danner there at Vice, except he leaves out the part where Obama fought for the Mujahideen in Libya and Syria for 3 years leading up to the declaration of the caliphate and the role that that played in its rise, which was huge. And you were warned about that too. Coburn. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. That's funny. I was just looking at Twitter, of course. Might as well have a Twitter chip in my brain at this point. And there, I have no idea what the article is, but it says some thoughts on that morning 29 years ago and the impact of small mistakes, and it's a picture of the Challenger crew. I'll never forget, I was in fourth grade at the time when the Challenger blew up. And if you know the story of that, oh, sorry for clearing my throat in your ear. If you know the story of that, the story is there was a military contractor, a NASA contractor called Morton Thiokol that made the booster rockets or parts of it or whatever. And there were guys, engineers and scientists on that crew who were terribly concerned that the rubber O-rings at the bottom part of those booster rockets would be compromised by the cold weather. That they needed to be warm in order to be flexible enough to fill the gaps and whatever the way they were supposed to. And they didn't, and so gas escaped. And then the rocket blew up, blowing up, of course, the other rocket, the fuel tank, and the shuttle itself, and killing all aboard. And the point of the story is, the reason I bring it up here, is because I was just fixing to talk about Libya and Syria. And it's such a perfect analogy when, especially those of you who listen to this show for a long time know that I'm wrong about stuff sometimes, wherever. I'm just trying to be right. I'm trying to think of what all are the best questions to try to understand what the hell is going on here or what the hell is going on over there. And then that means that we get not just the facts, but the perspective about what's going on in some of these wars that they don't hear in D.C., that even on the National Security Council, things that everybody in the room knows are true, that they pretend aren't true. And, you know, in the case of the Morton Thiokol thing, they had objected and said, hey, no, we got a problem with the booster rocket. And then there was basically political pressure because they kept having to delay the launch. And they had Christy McAuliffe was the teacher who was going to be on board. And this was a whole Ronald Reagan morning in America kind of thing going on here, guys. And what the hell is going on? They have to keep postponing it for the weather. And the bosses at Morton Thiokol and the liaison to NASA made it clear that they want a go-ahead, but they still had to talk to one level higher up. And they had a whole room full of guys. Perfect social psychology experiment for you. They have a whole room full of engineers and managers and middle managers and bosses and then the NASA guys who are the liaison to the contractor and all this. And they're in the room and they're on a conference call. And they say, does anybody object to us going forward this morning? And there are a few people in the room who absolutely object, who are going crazy over there, hair on fire, as they might say. And what do? They all bite their tongue. Why? Because that's what their boss wanted them to do. They thought, at least, good enough. The professor in the white lab coat said, the experiment requires that you proceed. And so they did, and a bunch of people died. And they blew up a giant zillion-dollar spaceship. Because none of them were man enough to just say, I don't care what happens to me after this. I don't care if I never engineer another rocket again. People are gonna die if you launch that goddamn spaceship today. Don't do it. No one was man enough, or woman enough, human enough, because the social psychology dynamics of the situation required shut up and make your boss look good. And if you read Secrets by Daniel Ellsberg, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, holy crap. Same thing, man. Every executive branch, it's different than at your work. I mean, even at your work, it's kind of like this. But in government work, it's just totally like this. Your only job is making your boss look good so that when he gets promoted, you can get his job. And maybe someday someone high enough will listen to what you think and then the world will have to do what you want. And it's so powerful. He says, you don't think that, you know, they say you can't keep a secret. Three people can't keep a secret because one will tell thousands of people, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of government employees, including Daniel Ellsberg, kept the secret of the Gulf of Tonkin fake attack from the American people. Thousands of them. It wasn't until Ellsberg himself leaked the Pentagon Papers that the secret was exposed. Yes, you can get people to keep a secret. How? By promising them a tiny bit more power and influence a little bit later. If they will just go along. And so even though on this show in 2011, my hair was on fire, and all of the smartest people that I know that I talk to about foreign policy, Phil Giraldi, Eric Margolies, David Enders, of course, Patrick Coburn, are saying, this is crazy. We're back in the Mujahideen. Michael Scheuer went on CNN and said, in the Libya war, the guys that were backing against Gaddafi right now, in any other place, we would call them the Mujahideen. These are Bin Laden-like guys. What are we doing? And they went, oh, now, Michael Scheuer, what do you know about Al-Qaeda? I'm sure Obama wouldn't be fighting a war for Al-Qaeda, because that would be crazy. So you must be wrong. That must not be what's going on here. You can look that up and watch the CNN thing. And he's just merciless. He's like, neither of you lip gloss girls know a damn thing about it. You're just carrying water for the president. And they're like, oh, well, I never. It's really hilarious. But the thing is, here's what I'm getting at. And I'm just making this up. This is a matter of speculation. I'm not claiming to know an actual fact on this particular point. But I'm just saying I think it's right that when Obama and Petraeus and Panetta and Hillary Clinton and them, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, when they're talking about getting into the Libya war, none of them, and probably none of their deputies, and maybe none of their deputies, were willing to say, hey, man, is someone going to mention how many of these guys are veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq? Is anyone going to talk about the completely Bin Ladenite loonies that live in that town, two towns east of Benghazi, that sent 70% of the fighters to go fight in the Sunni-based insurgency in our last war against us? Is anybody going to examine that before we lie the American people into this war? Did they even have an honest conversation about, hey, let's pretend that Gaddafi's about to murder 100,000 people, everyone in Benghazi, all of them, every man, woman, and child, and little bitty baby, too, and their dogs, are all going to be murdered by Gaddafi if we don't stop them. Did they even admit to each other that they were lying at the time? Or did they just say, look, Mr. President, here's a thing we could say. Yeah, I guess. Okay. And he went and he said he was in Charlotte. He was traveling, didn't even give us a talk from the Oval Office. He was just on the road raising money or whatever. And he just kind of mentioned it and said, it's a town the size of Charlotte. Could be wiped off the face of the earth. Everyone killed. And yeah, and Susan Rice says Gaddafi, well, they must have known they were lying when they claimed Gaddafi had passed out Viagra to his entire army and they were too busy raping anyone to kill every man, woman, and child in Benghazi. Whatever it takes. He's a Hitler and hey, look, a fetus, and whatever it takes to get you, the apathetic, docile masses, to go along. In fact, most Americans weren't even aware. Yes, I was plagiarizing Bill Hicks entirely just now, for those of you who were listening. I'm not trying to steal that. I just inspiration. Whatever you, the... He's a Hitler. Look, he's a Hitler. Huh, that's funny. Reagan tried to kill him once, and then, meh. I guess Reagan didn't realize what a Hitler he was. Anyway, and then, as covered on this show all along, as covered by Patrick Coburn all along, as covered by David Enders and all these great reporters all along, as covered by Phil Giraldi from the very friggin' beginning, there's a CIA operation to transfer jihadis and guns to Syria. America is hijacking the protest movement in Syria, and this is from the first months of 2011. America and Saudi Arabia are waging a counter-revolution. By June at the latest, I think maybe earlier, April or May, Eric Margolies was reporting, according to French intelligence sources, that French intelligence and special forces guys were on the ground helping organize the Sunni-based insurgency in Syria. According to early reports, very early reports in the spring of 2011, Prince Bandar from Saudi Arabia is helping to send the Mujahideen to Syria. And then who should be surprised that what was left of Al-Qaeda in Iraq rose up to take advantage of the situation? And I don't think it's right that al-Nusra and ISIS and or ISIS were working directly for the Americans or the Saudis or the Turks all along. But boy, they've been working with them. They've been working with them. And I mean us, our side, them. The Al-Nusra Front, they have their own agenda, but the Turks and the Saudis and the Americans have been happy to help them along. And these guys, it is treason, man. There's no other way to say it. These guys have sworn their loyalty. To be a member of Al-Nusra means swearing your loyalty to Al-Qaeda and its leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. And these are the guys, every time America, and it's in the Wall Street Journal today, entire divisions of guys trained and armed and funded by America have joined up with ISIS and Nusra. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. So anyway, I couldn't hear that bumper music, so I screwed up my going out to that last break. All I was trying to say was that Al-Qaeda in Iraq came to Syria when America, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey made it easy for them to do so. Assad would have won that war right away, except for the foreign intervention by America and its allies. And all along, there have been stories of training of jihadis in Jordan and guys being sent from Saudi Arabia, weapons being procured from all over the world. And even the Washington Post and the New York Times all along, it's not even conspiracy theory, whatever at all. It's blatant. David Sanger, even in the New York Times, the jihadis are the ones getting all the weapons. I played the clip for you a million times of Hillary Clinton saying, well, geez. And of course, she wanted to back the rebels more. But what she says is, you know, Zawahiri, she's defending the president's policy of not doing more to overthrow Assad, because this was, of course, the narrative all along, is Assad somehow, never mind who his actual enemies are. And so in defense of the administration, Hillary said, look, Ayman al-Zawahiri has endorsed the rebellion in Syria. So are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Hey, look. Hamas has endorsed the rebellion in Syria. Are we supporting Hamas? And she wasn't saying directly, but she was saying, hey, look, in effect, are we helping to create space for these guys? We don't want to do that. That would be, you know, to weaken Assad is to empower our enemies too. So we have to be very careful. And she goes on, this is March 2012, CBS, hell, I guess I got to play the damn clip now. I can find it for you here. Where she says, and we don't see anyone to replace Assad with either. Okay, so here, first, hope no beasties are playing in the background or anything for you here. Let me see. Oh, come on, man, go.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
Right. No, there you go. That's Hillary in March of 2012 talking to CBS News. There's nobody to back except a bunch of suicide bombers. Jabhat al-Nusra is al-Qaeda in Syria, sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri. The entire FSA are just the guys who get the guns and the money and bring them to al-Nusra. Basically. The so-called moderates, and I'm sorry I have such a broken record on this for people who've been listening all along, but as you know, it ain't like the truth has won out on the battle for the narrative here. The so-called moderates are made up of groups like the Farouk Brigade. If you just read the New York Times piece, the Wall Street Journal piece about this. Well, the Farouk Brigade, yeah, they're Islamist bin Ladenites. Oh, no, but they're nice bin Ladenites. They want to hold elections. They just figure that the Sunni supermajority will win the elections, just like the Shiites did in Iraq in 2005. And so, great. Meanwhile, their leader was the guy who's dead now, but was on film eating a man's heart. Or was it his lung? Or was it his liver? A dead Syrian soldier. Yeah, they're real moderate, the Al-Farouk Brigade. And then there's John McCain's friends. You might remember this controversy from when Rand Paul screwed up and went with some low-level, half-baked crap information that he picked up from who knows where, that John McCain had met with ISIS based on idiots pretending to match up photos of people who they think when they don't know what the hell they're talking about. But it wasn't ISIS that he met with, Rand Paul. It was the Northern Storm Brigade. And the Northern Storm Brigade, guess who they are? Oh, yeah, they're veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, too. They're Syrian veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they're on film telling Time Magazine, on video, on the internet, telling Time Magazine, their leader says, yeah, we're all veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We fought against the Americans in Iraq. But that was then, and this is now. And that was before John McCain ever went to meet with them. So if Rand Paul hadn't blown it, boy, what a great accusation he could have made out of that. But it's not like Rand Paul's style to even hire anyone who knows how to use Google, huh? Can't even get it right when he's trying to get it right, which is less than half the time. But anyway, yeah, John McCain's guilty of treason. John McCain's standing there on the porch, not with ISIS, but with guys who are just as evil and, in fact, are more America's enemy. And if they fought with Zarqawi in Iraq against American soldiers, I mean, I guess that makes them... Yeah, but see, but they're still sworn loyal to Zawahiri. They are still Zawahiri's group. Whereas ISIS, they've killed some of our hostages and that kind of thing, but and they've attacked France... possibly, a grocery store in France, but they've not attacked the United States, not yet, but al-Nusra and the Northern Storm, well, geez, seems bad enough to me if Rand ever got his facts right, but anyway, these are the so-called moderates, the al-Farouk cannibals and the Northern Storm veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and then other than them, whose insurgency has it been this whole time? And I shouldn't say other than them as though they're the predominant part of the thing at all. The Al-Farouk Brigade and the Northern Storm are tiny little things compared to the real leaders of the Syrian insurgency this whole time, Jabhat al-Nusra, which really ruled the whole thing from, say, mid to late 2012 all the way through the spring of 2013 when ISIS split off. When Baghdadi and Golani had their personality conflict, and Baghdadi claimed the whole thing was the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and the Nusra guys said, no, we're just fighting in Syria. And Zawahiri from Al-Qaeda, told Baghdadi and them, hey, you guys go back to Iraq and fight and leave Syria to al-Nusra. And Baghdadi said, what's Iraq? Old man hiding in a basement in Pakistan, try to tell me what to do. You hide in your basement, and I'm going to do what I want, which is refuse to even concede that Iraq and Syria are things that exist or ever existed. And how do you like that? And what was, you know, Zawahiri should have known better than to give those kinds of contradictory direct orders that he has no ability to enforce whatsoever from Pakistan. But anyway, he sucks at being a terrorist, I guess. So that was where the Islamic State broke off and then a year later declared themselves an actual state with the sack and the Mosul. So there you see how George W. Bush gave all of western and northwestern Iraq to bin Ladenites for a time. To rise up and train in their giant terrorist academy for years, for 2003 through 2007. And then they were pretty much marginalized, but not eradicated. And then Obama went and he took Bush's blundering treason, and he quite deliberately, or I don't know, I mean, never mind his thought process, he actively took the side of the bin Ladenites in Libya and Syria. And so where George Bush just did them the greatest favor anyone could have possibly fathomed ever, Obama tripled it. He tripled it. And it's just incredible. It's a history I can hardly believe myself, even though I've been complaining about it daily the whole time on this show. Mark Danner also points out how the torture and the occupation and all of this has been the best recruitment all along, and how bombing since August has helped too.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. All right, so you might have noticed that Benjamin Netanyahu is often quoted saying, hey, listen, our enemy is Islamic extremist terrorism and Iran. Oh, God. What they're counting on, beware of anyone who quite clearly in his statements is counting on you being stupid. Who has, I'm trying to deceive you by conflating opposite things together, right in his statement. Al-Qaeda and ISIS are the direct opposites of the Iranian regime. They're avowed enemies. And they're the ones who are killing ISIS guys in greater numbers than anybody else. The Iranian Quds Force in Iraq and their sock puppets, the ones George W. Bush put in power, the Badr Brigade of the Supreme Islamic Council, quote-unquote, the Iraqi police, quote-unquote, the Iraqi army, the Badr Corps, and their related militias, working at the behest of the Iranians. And what Netanyahu wants is for America to not have a nuclear deal with Iran, not get along with Iran, and in fact, what would be even better would be a war against Iran. And even when the President of the United States is right in the middle of trying to wrap up a nuclear deal, Netanyahu's idea is, screw that. No, I forbid it. I'm telling you what to do because I'm the boss of you, and no, I'll do everything I can to stop it. Because as Michael Oren, his former ambassador to the United States as of about a year and a couple of months ago, who is actually denouncing him right now for this, if you can believe it, for political reasons of his own, of course, but still, as he said, we prefer these bad guys to those bad guys. And this is, of course, a huge part of why America has supported this policy in favor of the Mujahideen in Syria against the Assad government since 2011, because that's what Israel wants. And that's what the neoconservatives and the Israel lobby in America wants. As Jeffrey Goldberg and President Obama discussed, oh, and I got my footnote wrong, it wasn't March of 2012, that Hillary Clinton quote is from February 2012. She said that to CBS News. But Jeffrey Goldberg and Obama, also in 2012, did an interview in the Oval Office in the Atlantic magazine where they talk about how, as Goldberg puts it, it seems like taking out Assad would be a great way to hurt Iran. Don't you think? And then Obama agrees that, yes, this is what we're trying to do. The reason that we're trying to regime change Assad is to weaken Iran. And, of course, he couches it like, oh, if we could replace him with a democratic something-something, when, no, the policy was not to try to hold a vote. The policy was to back the Mujahideen in a war. And Obama even jokes, almost, I'd tell you, but I'd have to kill you. But he says, oh, you know, there are other things that we are doing that I can't let you know about, Jeffrey Goldberg. And Jeffrey Goldberg giggles, and it's a whole little thing, you know. I'd tell you, but I'd have to kill you, kind of funny little moment. And that's the policy, because that's what Israel wants. You know, simply. And, oops. And Michael Oren, actually, he told the Jerusalem Post, yes, we prefer these bad guys to those bad guys because those bad guys are backed by Iran, meaning he prefers Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS to Hezbollah and Assad and the Iranians. And he was specific about it. He said so, I believe, to the Jerusalem Post, but he clarified on stage with Jeffrey Goldberg, again, from the Atlantic magazine. It's on YouTube. You just type in Michael Oren, O-R-E-N, Goldberg, Sunnis. And there's the video on YouTube. Will come right up. And they're at the Aspen Institute of, you know, I guess billionaires who get together in Aspen and talk about ruling the world together. And so in very comfortable circumstances, Michael Oren explains to Jeffrey Goldberg. And Jeffrey Goldberg backs up and goes, whoa, I ain't on board for that. And he disclaims a couple of times and says, I'm only speaking for myself. But then he continues to say, so from the point of view of the Israeli government, and I think you can pretty much believe the latter there. And what he's saying is, yes, even if they're suicide bombers, even if they are Osama bin Ladenites, even if I'm not pretending we're talking about tribal, moderate, awakening council types. Let's be clear, Michael Oren says. He prefers bin Ladenite suicide bombers to Bashar al-Assad because Bashar al-Assad is friends with Hezbollah in Iran. Now, that might be perfectly fine, and I guess if you put Israel first, then that's perfectly fine, even though that's crazy and you're stupid, because how could you possibly think that Israel is better off with a bunch of bin Ladenite suicide bomber types on their northern border rather than the very stable and, as far as Israel's concerned, peaceful government of the Assad regime. Don't give me that crap about Assad's trying to make nukes back in 2007 and all that, because my wife and others completely debunked that story at the time. It was not a nuclear facility that they bombed. The whole thing's a hoax. Assad might as well be an Israeli agent this whole time. He's so docile. And yet, good enough isn't good enough for the Israelis ever. And so this mad policy. And then what they would have, and I try to watch Fox News as much as I can. I try to, you know, follow right wingers on Twitter and look at the things that they say. And, you know, their entire premise is forget trying to parse any difference between any enemy of Israel's or America's anywhere. Just, you know what the problem is? Muslims. You know what the problem is? Arabs. You know what the problem is? Them over there. And what they're trying to get out of you, the American focus group, is the reaction. I say just turn the whole place to glass. Just nuke them all. Americans like saying stuff like that. Just nuke them all. That's what they're trying to get you to do. Because what a complicated mess to try to tell a Shia from a Sunni, to try to tell Iran from its enemies. Because they have an agenda. And now it's true that there are a lot of American imperialists who also hate Iran and will never forgive them for declaring independence from the United States, etc., like that. But no, it's the Israelis and their American fifth column's obsession with Iran that has made the policy this way. And now it's gone to such an extent where this, I think, idiot, and I bet you he's in trouble for this now, this idiot Ron Dermer, who replaced Michael Oren to be the new ambassador to the United States. He rigged this thing with John Boehner, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, to bring Netanyahu to Capitol Hill to try to end run the President of the United States on a peace negotiation. It's not like the President's trying to lie us into war and he's trying to help us out by saying, wait, it doesn't have to be this way. This is a president on a de facto peace treaty, on a first major step toward ending the Cold War with Iran. And Netanyahu is coming to town to try to corral the American people back into an Israel-first, anti-Shiite crescent-first policy. It'll be an interesting test. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, I don't know. 10-minute segments, they screw me up. But it is what it is. So, here's what it is. The Menendez sanctions are being delayed. They're not even going to introduce them. They're so they are facing such opposition that they've decided to wait. So I guess Netanyahu's still coming, but it's already a lost cause. When they're announcing today that they're not going to pass the sanctions, they won't introduce them until after the negotiations are over, if they fail, the new deadline being in March. So just like what happened last year, Obama said in the State of the Union, don't pass the sanctions, you're screwing up my negotiations. And they're going, okay, boss, whatever. Because for crying out loud, he's the president. And those, you know, it's funny, though. It's sort of like, why did Eli Lake write this? Why would the Congress do this? Maybe it's because the Mossad is working against Netanyahu, and they are more loyal to Mossad than to the Israeli prime minister. And if Mossad says that this will ruin the negotiations, then better do what they say, right, Congress? Is that it? Because Mossad came out and threw the prime minister under the bus and said you might have the Republican Party and the Democrats, but you don't have your own intelligence agency, which says that you suck. And looks like maybe that was what did it. So that's good news. And, you know, honestly, I think that the deal's going to happen. All of the, basically, the deal is this. In case you don't know, I'll try to sum it up for you real quick now. The Iranian nuclear program is already safeguarded by the IAEA. That means they have an ATF cop hanging out in their gun shop, in their gun factory. Okay? They have cops who live at their freaking place, basically. So, in other words, nothing is happening that the IAEA doesn't know about. From the mining to the conversion, you know, the refining to ore, then the conversion to uranium hexafluoride gas, the introduction into the centrifuges, the stockpiling in whatever amounts, and then transformation into fuel rods. Every step of the use of nuclear material by the Iranian government is inspected, safeguarded by the IAEA. It's a civilian program. The only nuclear weapons program that they have is the pretend one that liars would have you believe in that doesn't actually exist, see? So the negotiations right now are for, hey, why don't you, you know, get your nuclear threshold status a little short of the finish line. We want you to have a breakout time of, it would take at least a year if you decided to make a nuke for you to make one. Give us plenty of time to go to war against you first. That's what they're negotiating, a longer breakout time. Because, and I know the right-wingers call it treason or whatever, but the stance that the Iranians may not have a nuclear program at all is completely unenforceable. It's completely ridiculous, completely make-believe, other than a full-scale war and invasion of a country three times the size of Iraq with four times the population and most of it mountains. So shut up. The best you can do is negotiate them into making extra super double lucky wish sure that their nuclear material is not diverted to a military or other special purpose, as they put it in the IAEA reports. It's already safeguarded. It's been safeguarded. They're not in violation of their safeguards agreement with the IAEA or in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which mandates their deal with the IAEA. They're not in violation. This entire negotiation is for them to dial back their theoretical breakout capability a bit and to allow for expanded inspections. In other words, an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement. So, in other words, the deal's already done. The only thing that's left to happen is for the Americans to stop being such dicks. That's it. And, you know what really did it, other than Mossad throwing Netanyahu under the bus, I think, was, as Jim Loeb pointed out on the show last week, Obama went and had the prime ministers and presidents of Britain, France, and Germany write a joint letter in the Washington Post. Can you believe that? That's what it takes to try to pry the Republican Party especially, but Congress as a whole, out from under the thumb of the prime minister of Israel, of a foreign state. You have to invoke the leadership of other foreign states. Guys, could you please tell these guys to knock it off already? Oh, but you're supposed to believe there's no daylight in between Israel's policy and America's, or Israel's interests and America's interests in the Middle East, even though everything that they want is the exact opposite of what's good for the U.S. and the American people. Even David Petraeus himself admitted it to the U.S. Senate under oath before he went crawling on his belly to Max Boot. What scum. David Petraeus. He went crawling on his belly before Max Boot and said, please tell the Israel lobby not to crucify me. Oh, would it help if I told you that I went and had dinner with Eli Wiesel the other night? Oh, I'm so sorry. Please call AEI and tell them to not kill me. And Max Boot said, no, it's okay, and went and wrote a thing at commentary. Hey, everybody, don't be mad at Petraeus. It was some sneaky staff member that snuck that in there. That Israel is undermining America's position in the Middle East. Getting Americans killed. This was during the Iraq War. Getting Americans killed. That's what he was referring to. Helping to radicalize the enemy against the American occupation. Just like, did you know? As the heroic Ray McGovern never ceases to remind us that it was the Israeli assassination of Yassin, I forget his first name, anyway, Sheikh Yassin in the Gaza Strip. He was the guy that Israel worked with to create Hamas in the first place as a right-wing religious alternative to the PLO. And they murdered him, guess when? In the spring, it would have been April 2004, which led to the giant riot in Fallujah and the lynching of the Blackwater Guards that then became the excuse for George Bush to do his full-scale invasion of Fallujah, which just radicalized the Sadrists on the Shia side in solidarity with the Sunnis then. That was before the worst of the Civil War, but helped cause it. Because all those refugees from Fallujah, all the actual jihadi-type fighters, they all went up to Mosul and spread their war up to Mosul, and all the civilian refugees all went to Baghdad, which led to a bunch of Shiites getting kicked out of their houses, which just helped lead to the cycle of violence back and forth in the sectarian cleansing of the capital city there. So, and it was, that's just one small example from that war. Never mind the fact that the Israelis helped lie America into it in the first place. Read James Bamford. What's the name of that book? Pretext for War. Read Katowski in Rumsfeld's Shop. And read, Robert Dreyfus, Agents of Influence in the Nation, for that one. All right, back in a second. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back. I swear to God I'm going to talk about Ukraine and the cops and some other things here in just a second. But first, I want to say, just so everybody's clear on the concept here, I actually have people ask me sometimes, so are you for Iran or against Iran? Whose side are you on anyway? Well, look, when it comes to Iran's nuclear program, I'm on the side of the truth. When it comes to Iran's intervention in Iraq, I'm on the side of the truth. When it comes to the politicians who run the Iranian government, I hate them as much as I possibly can. Why? They're politicians. And maybe unlike you, I mean it when I say I hate politicians. I really mean it. All of them. And these guys, what, they claim... theocratic control over people's minds and beliefs. There are tens of thousands of Jews and other religious minorities in Iran. It's not like everyone is forced to convert to Shiism or anything like that. But just anyway, they are theocrats. The supreme leader's supposed authority comes from the Shiite church, in a manner of speaking. And if he was democratically elected, I'd still hate him anyway. And when you look at George Bush's decision to completely destroy the 21st century for no good damn reason at all, mostly it was because of him. It's all on him. But the guy who supplied him with the best lies to get us into that war was Ahmed Chalabi, who was an Iranian agent. He was his own agent. But he was also sponsored by the government of Iran. Hell, INC headquarters was in Tehran. And if you just read, depending on your emotional state, you will laugh your ass off or cry, you know, drowning in your tears. If you read how Chalabi conned the neocons. I know it's in Salon.com, but they used to have actual good journalism in there rather than before it turned into just the Huffington Post or whatever. Also, the guy that wrote it is actually a decades-long veteran, I believe, of the Financial Times. Either the Financial Times or the Economist or something. It was like a one-off that he wrote for Salon. So it's not some Salon.com piece of crap, okay? It just happens to be at Salon.com, okay? It's called How Ahmed Chalabi Conned the Neocons. And it's the story of Richard Perle and his fellow Israeli Fifth Column being really stupid. And believing these guys when they said, listen, what we'll do is we'll get rid of the Baathists, we'll get rid of the Sunnis, and we'll turn the country over to the Shiite majority, the same ones that George H.W. Bush backstabbed by encouraging them to rise up and then left them high and dry in the Great Bay of Pigs in the desert in 1991. We will put them in power. And then, you're right, Paul Wolfowitz, what'll happen is, they'll be such Jeffersonian Democrats and create a limited constitutional republic and let associated friends of the American Enterprise Institute run off with all their oil and whatever, that it's going to make all of the Shia in Iran next door jealous that they only have a kind of pretend democracy and that they want a more better one. And so Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, they bought this. But then, of course, and Landay, I brought this up to Landay on the show, Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers. He says, I was there. I watched Abdul Aziz al-Hakim and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution cross the border from Iran into Kurdistan in the spring of 2003. Ha ha ha. The fulfillment of the Ayatollah's evil scheme to trick George W. Bush, the stupid idiot, into doing what Osama wanted, into doing what Ariel Sharon wanted, into doing what the Ayatollah wanted. Get rid of Saddam Hussein and create a giant, horrible war. And so that's what Bush did. Because the neocons told him to do it. They told Dick Cheney it would be perfect. We got it, all the details worked out. We've been working very carefully with this Ahmed Chalabi fella. And it's going to be great. And instead, you know what it turned out to be? It turned out to be exactly what Dick Cheney warned it would be back in 1994. When he was, at that time, shades of Hillary Clinton apologizing for not doing enough against Assad in that clip from February 2012. Here's Cheney from 1994 on C-SPAN at the American Enterprise Institute, defending the position against the popular meme in the 1990s that we should have gone all the way to Baghdad instead of leaving that mean old Saddam in there. No sanctions, no blockade, no no-fly zone bombing campaign are good enough for him. We need a regime change there. George H.W. Bush's greatest failure is he didn't get a regime change there. And so the naive questioner asked Dick Cheney, so why didn't you do it? And Dick Cheney says, well, if we had, first of all, you'd have had the Americans getting shot at trying to occupy Baghdad, getting sniped at in an urban environment. And how many American lives is Saddam Hussein worth? Our decision was not very damn many, he said. And then he said, and plus, you'd have had the Iranians try to run off with the South. You'd have had the Syrians run off with the west of the country. And I don't know if at the time he meant the Syrian Sunnis in the east of Syria, and that would break Syria apart too. What a mess. And then you have the whole question of an independent Kurdistan, which would cause problems with our allies, the Turks, he said, who were at that time, with Bill Clinton's help, in the middle of financing a half a genocide by the state of Turkey against their domestic Kurdish population in the mid-1990s. He said it would be an absolute disaster, and that's not why to do it. So when it comes to the Iraq war, I'm as anti-Iranian as anyone can get. Now, that doesn't mean I'll carry a bunch of water for David Petraeus and all of his lies that Muqtada al-Sadr was the Iran-backed one. He was the Arab nationalist among the Shiite leaders. It was the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawah Party that Petraeus was backing who were backed by Iran. And he was a damn liar, lying in the service of Dick Cheney, trying to blame all of America's troubles in Iraq, not on our Saudi friends who'd been backing the Sunni-based insurgency against us all along, but on the Iranians for backing the same guys that we're fighting for? What? Ordered a surge into Sadr City to fight one-third of the Shiite coalition we fought the whole war for just to throw some lives away for nothing in 2007. There's a whole book about it called The Good Soldiers. It's an absolute, just, it's madness. I tried to explain this to a friend of mine. He kept trying to make it make sense, and so he was confused. And I told him, let go. It doesn't make sense because it's crazy. This is what happened. So, no, I will not go along with lies about Iran and their intervention in the Iraq war, but I will absolutely condemn every single person in their entire government for participating in that policy, for helping get a million people killed. A million people. For helping to ruin the 21st century from now on, when it didn't have to be like this at all. A sectarian war that's going to rage for decades, and that America's going to be involved in for decades. So, just because I'm expert at 100% acquitting the Iranians on the pretended threat of their civilian nuclear program, I'm first in line to accuse them of things that they're actually guilty of. Because what I hate is politicians. And, because of the lies and the violence. See? And that's why liberals and conservatives are confused about libertarians as parties in power switch. I thought everybody was supposed to not care about the war anymore once Obama got elected, huh? I see left-wing radicals on Twitter defending Obama. It's easy to see why you hate the conservatives, sure. But really? Obama, who waged a surge, doubled, tripled the war in Afghanistan? Who launched an entire new drone war in Pakistan, in Yemen, and special forces war in Somalia, throughout Africa? Who supported the Mujahideen in Libya, spread that war to Mali, who supported the Mujahideen in Syria, turned that war into the ultimate catastrophe of a bin Laden clone declaring himself the caliph of the Islamo-fascist caliphate that never existed but in George W. Bush's fantasy until Obama made it that way? Come on. Even after 6 years of this, people are just getting more and more impressed with Obama no matter who he kills, no matter whose interests he serves. It's easier to just hate all politicians and all the things they do, and then you don't have to suffer all the cognitive dissonance, you know? That's why I look so youthful at 38. Save myself that stress. All right. Thanks for listening to The Stress. See you tomorrow.